Hey, Dan here. Before we start the show, I want to tell you about a live recording of this podcast that we're doing in New York City on March 28th. I will be interviewing two frequent flyers from this show, the legendary meditation teacher Joseph Goldstein, who will be just coming off a three-month solo silent meditation retreat, and Dr. Mark Epstein, a Buddhist therapist and best-selling author. The event will actually be a celebration of the 10th anniversary of my first book, 10% Happier, and a percentage of the proceeds will go to the New York Insight Meditation Center. Come early if you want for a VIP guided meditation and Q&A with me. Thanks to our friends over at Audible for sponsoring this show and the event. Tickets on sale right now at symphonyspace.org. This is the 10% Happier Podcast. I'm Dan Harris. Hello, everybody. How we doing? We are diving into the deep end today with Dr. Mark Epstein, one of the most important people in my own meditation career. Before we dive in with Mark, let me tell you a little story. I first got turned on to Mark Epstein through my wife, Bianca, who gave me one of Mark's books back in 2009, might have been 2008, whatever the date. This happened during a period of time when I was first getting interested in the self-help world, for lack of a better term. I had been reading books by people like Eckhart Tolle and Deepak Chopra. I'd even hung out with both of those guys. I found them compelling, especially their focus on how we all have a voice in our heads, an inner narrator, an ego that is constantly launching us into the past or the future instead of being awake right now, and also frequently serving up deeply terrible ideas. So I was compelled by guys like Deepak and Eckhart, but also quite frustrated, especially with Tolle, because I didn't feel like he provided any practical advice for dealing with this aspect of the human condition, the voice in our heads. So my wife, having heard me talk about all of this with varying levels of cogency, finally remembered that she had read a book many years earlier that touched on many of the same issues that I was wrestling with in the moment. And it was Mark's book. So she handed me the book and I was looking at it and I liked this guy immediately because he had actual credentials. He's a Harvard-trained psychiatrist. By the way, the book Bianca gave me was called Going to Pieces Without Falling Apart, and it's one of many books that Mark has written about the overlap between ancient Buddhism and modern psychology. That night, reading Mark's book in bed, that was my first real exposure to Buddhism. And I realized that 2,600 years before Eckhart Tolle and Deepak Chopra started cashing their royalty checks, it was the Buddha who was talking about the voice in the head. He called it the monkey mind. And he, the Buddha, actually had practical and doable advice for managing the monkey mind, the ego, whatever you want to call it. The advice was that you should meditate. So after reading Mark's book, I called him up and asked him if he would be willing to grab a beer with me. He was, and we did, and we really hit it off. And he essentially became my mentor and guide during my on-ramp to Buddhism and meditation. It was incredibly generous of him, and we're still good friends today. I wrote all about Mark and our relationship in my book, 10% Happier. He kind of plays a Tuesdays with Maury role where I keep touching base with him as I learn to fit meditation into my busy life as a newsman. So I'm having Mark back on the show today because we're in the middle of a special series to celebrate the 10th anniversary of 10% Happier. By the way, I just put out a special revised anniversary edition of the book with a new preface and expanded appendix filled with meditation instructions. If you want to check that out, I've put a link in the show notes. Anyway, back to this podcast series. During the month of March, I'm going to talk to many of the key players in the book, including Deepak Chopra, Joseph Goldstein, and Spring Washam. And today it's Mark. When I asked Mark what he wanted to talk about, he uttered the following words: emptiness as the mother's love. You will hear Mark explain what exactly he means by this, but for now I will say that that combination of words is classic Mark. It's a mixture of Dharma lingo and psychological terminology. It may sound esoteric, but it's actually readily accessible and quite practical. We also talk about the insubstantial nature of thoughts, staying present through anything without clinging or condemning, turning down the volume on your ego and focusing on other people, how to transform your neuroses from monsters to little schmooze, and whether 10% is the right number. One last thing before we dive in here. You will notice at the end of the interview, Mark and I hint at getting a future retreat on the books. In other words, we talk about he and I leading a meditation retreat together. As it turns out, in the weeks since we recorded this episode, Mark and I have actually planned a retreat together that we will be hosting. It's coming up in January of 2025. We're going to do it at a beautiful resort and spa called Miraval, which is in Arizona. If you want to come, just click the link in the show notes. And as always, if you want to keep up to date on what I'm doing, you can sign up for my newsletter at danharris.com and follow me on social. But first, a little BSP, blatant self-promotion. Two little things to tell you about, then one big thing. First little thing, if you go to danharris.com, my new website, there's a merch store up where you can get 10% happier t-shirts and sweatshirts and a tote bag. Also, if you go to danharris.com, you can sign up for my new newsletter in which I share the two biggest takeaways for me from the shows on any given week, plus three cultural recommendations, books, TV shows, movies, TikTok videos, you name it. Okay, here's the big thing I really want to promote. We've got a meditation party retreat coming up at the Omega Institute, which is outside of New York City. That's coming up in May. There's actually another one coming up after that in November. This is a weekend-long thing I do with the great meditation teachers, Sebane Selassie and Jeff Warren. It is not your traditional silent meditation retreat. We call it meditation party for a reason. We do many sessions where we have a lot of conversation among the three of us on stage. We do some guided meditations. We take questions from the audience. It's highly interactive. There's a dance party on Saturday night. We've got a great DJ, Tasha the Amazon, who's coming to play some jams on Saturday night. Come for this. The last one we did was incredibly fun, so we're doing two more this year. Go to eomega.com to sign up or to the link in the show notes. Before I go, I just want to say something about the 10% Happier app. Many of you are familiar with the great teachings of Joseph Goldstein, the amazing meditation teacher. We've got six courses and more than 50 guided meditations from Joseph over on the app, including our free introductory course, The Basics. Download the 10% Happier app today, wherever you get your apps, and get started for free. I'll also link to it in the show notes. Audible lets you enjoy all your audio entertainment in one app. You'll always find the best of what you love or something new to discover. They offer an incredible selection of audiobooks across every genre. And when it comes to thrillers, they have you covered for any type of excitement you're looking for. With celebrity narration, multicast productions, with immersive sound design, and traditional audiobooks, you will be sure to find a compelling audio title. The book I've been checking out lately is called Devil Makes Three. It's by Ben Fountain. It's extraordinarily well written, and it takes you into Haiti in the 1990s. And obviously, the narrative has a lot of extra punch right now, given what's happening on the ground in Haiti as we speak. Highly recommend this book. Ben Fountain is an incredible writer. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from the entire catalog, including the latest bestsellers and new releases. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/10% or text 10% to 500-500. That's audible.com/10% or text 10% to 500-500 to try Audible free for 30 days. audible.com/TENPERCENT.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Dr. Mark Epstein, welcome back to the show.
Dan Harris.
It's been probably 15 years since I met you or something like that.
I was wondering about that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's scary.
I know. I think it was 2009 that I emailed you and begged you to be my friend, and here we are.
Wow, I'm glad I agreed.
Well, so when we were chatting over dinner recently about what we could talk about in this interview, you used a phrase that is so packed with meaning that I suspect the whole conversation could be about this. The phrase was emptiness as the mother's love.
Uh-huh.
And so does that sound familiar to you?
That sounds like something I would say. Yeah, over dinner. Yeah. Yeah, as we got into it. Yeah.
Okay, so let's just start with that as an intriguing phrase to start a conversation. Perhaps it's best to begin picking that phrase apart with the word emptiness. What do you mean by that?
Oh, you're starting with the most difficult thing in Buddhism. Well, let's talk about what it doesn't mean. Okay. It doesn't mean that nothing matters, or that nothing is real, or that it doesn't mean nothingness, emptiness. Okay, it's got another meaning from the Buddhist point of view. My friend Robert Thurman always says they picked the word emptiness because fullness was already taken. So, but they could have just as well said fullness. And the other thing he said about that is that the root of the Sanskrit word, which is shunyata, you know, shunyata means emptiness. The root comes from svi, which means the swelling of a seed, like in a pregnant womb. So emptiness from the Buddhist side connotes like a full emptiness, the equivalent to that of a pregnant womb. So it's like the womb that holds potential. All those notes are part of it. Emptiness as relationality would be the other way to talk about it. Emptiness is the realization that nothing exists in and of itself as an independent, self-sustaining, isolated thing. Everything, including you and me and what goes on inside of us, etc., is connected in some way to everything else. All that is part of what the word is meant to suggest. And it's thought to be a realization that precipitates out of meditation practice, that if you just sit and watch yourself, as we try to do practicing mindfulness, that naturally your understanding of quote-unquote emptiness or shunyata will emerge out of that process. Somewhat mysterious thing. That phrase, whatever I used when we were having dinner the other night, emptiness as the mother's love, one of the experiences that I had that led me to that was teaching at Tibet House with Robert Thurman. And he, in the midst of, I think I was talking about Winnicott and the good enough mother and, you know, how to bring a Buddhist understanding to psychotherapy and child rearing and, you know, all of this. And he pulled out a 19th century Mongolian poem that he had once translated that began with the phrase, "I was like a mad child, long lost my old mother, never could find her, though she was with me always." And as he was reciting that poem, something in me sort of started choking up, like I was a mad child. I was like a mad child, long lost his old mother. On an emotional, psychological level, I could relate. But it turns out the poem is about the discovery of emptiness, which the Mongolian poet was calling mother emptiness, you know, because the feeling was, oh, I've been searching and searching for this realization, and I thought it was this, you know, I couldn't find it anywhere. I thought it was nothingness. I thought I had to get rid of everything about myself. And then I was like a mad child, long lost this thing, which had been with me always. And then he discovers emptiness as the equivalent of his long-lost mother's love in the pure relationality of his being. That was the point. So all of that was filtering through me when we were talking about this. And I could go on about it if you dare me.
I do dare you. Let me hopefully provoke the next round of going on by probably clumsily attempting to restate the core thesis. Let me see if I can
good.
Do that.
No, you're and good then, at this. Yeah.
Well, I want you to fact check me. So somebody came up with the term emptiness.
Yeah. Nagarjuna, probably.
Oh, okay. I thought it was some English translator of ancient Dharmic principles.
Well, I think in English, it was an English translator, but I think it was Nagarjuna who brought emptiness to the fore in the three marks of existence, you know, of dukkha, anicca, and anatta. They don't include shunyata as one of the marks of existence. It's impermanence, insubstantiality, and unsatisfactoriness. And then emptiness comes in a couple hundred years later. And it's traditionally Nagarjuna whose poetry was the original source of the concept, as I understand it.
You just threw out some terms. Let me just see if I can unpack them.
Go ahead.
As the dummy in the conversation and make sure that everybody can grasp it. In Buddhism, we talk a lot about the three characteristics. It's so funny to say we Buddhists now, because when I met you, I was
you're what?
Anything
you've joined
but,
the cult.
Yes, I have. We talk about the three characteristics of existence, the three things you can see about reality if you meditate and pay attention to the world.
Even if you don't meditate, the three marks of existence, they say.
The first is impermanence. Everything's changing all the time. It's not hard to grasp. The second is suffering, which is a tricky word. A better way to say it would be unsatisfactoriness, that because things are changing all the time, you're never going to get some sort of lasting satisfaction out of that next bite of cake or the next promotion, because you'll always want something more. The thing that you finally managed to grasp is in itself changing. And so life is unsatisfactory. And if you cling too hard, you will suffer. The third is not self. Meaning that we feel very much like we are isolated egos navigating a dangerous world. But actually, there, if you look hard enough internally, you won't find some solid core nugget of self. You then went on to say that an ancient Buddhist scholar and thinker named Nagarjuna was the one who said, well, maybe there's a fourth mark of existence and it's emptiness. I always thought that not self and emptiness were basically the same.
I think they are, except not self is self-referential in a certain way, that the way, you know, the way we think about it, and emptiness is a broader instinctive need that we have to impute thingness into ourselves and others extends into all of experience. Emptiness is like a broader way of looking at it, I think.
Got it. So the word empty, and this is where I was starting to go before,
yeah.
I think it was chosen because it was trying to point to the fact that everything is empty of an essence. We might feel like there is some core nugget of us, a soul or something findable within our mind, between our ears, behind our eyes. We may feel that that chair I'm sitting on is 1,000% chair. But actually, if you look closely at the chair or your mind, you won't find an essence of chair or Mark or Dan.
Yeah.
And that is what is being pointed to through the term emptiness. Am I close?
I think so. I mean, the essence, using the word essence as the definition of it is, I think, one traditional way of talking about it. So in my mind, as you're talking, the word entitativeness is one that I have heard repeated a lot that has sort of stuck with me. It sort of goes with certainty that the instinctive thing for an anxious self in a scary world is to want things to be solid, certain, to have a solidity, to have a structure, to have an entitativeness that we can count on. I think emptiness is undercutting that. Emptiness is said, that's why the physicists, you know, or the people who like to read about the equivalency of quantum physics and Buddhism, the underlying quantum reality that the physicists seem to have pointed to fits with a Buddhist idea of emptiness, whether it's actually the same thing or not, who knows, but it's getting at a similar kind of, oh my God, we think this is real, but we could actually put our finger through it. And there's some subjective experience of that tends to come with meditation that can be scary, but also can give a sense of loosening up or some kind of sense of freedom when we see that we don't have to be doing that all the time.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but that notion that emptiness or insubstantiality or lack of entitativeness is scary at first, but ultimately liberating. It feels to me that that was maybe what you were pointing to when you talked about emptiness as a mother's love.
Yeah, there's some way that all this connects up with love, that the understanding that one's own separateness is illusory. If your separateness is illusory, then you must be connected. And so if we're not separate the way we imagine we are, and we're actually connected in a way that we don't quite understand, what is it that makes the connection? Then that becomes sort of obvious. Like, what is it that connects us all, really? It must be some kind of love. So when they pull back from love, some of the Buddhists, then they just talk about relationality or relativity, that nothing exists without our observation of it. Like we're always in a subjective mode in our experience of the world. So the thing doesn't exist separate from our perception of it. That's another way of trying to get at the same thing. But that, I feel like that can be too remote, pulls back too much. That the actual experience that tends to dawn in meditation is of some kind of heart opening, that, oh, I'm not this scared, isolated person that I deep down am afraid that I am, but actually I'm a loving being. And I think that's where the mother's love comes in, that we all come from that. That's what the Mongolian Lama's poem is about. I was like a mad child, long lost my old mother, never could find her, though she was with me always. We all come from that. That's the great evolution, the great mammalian evolution, that the mother gives birth of the child from her own body. We're immediately, like, we make eye contact, we're immediately connected. The relationality is there from the beginning. So it's a kind of inherent capacity that we all have as evolved creatures. And there's some kind of recovery of that comes through the Dharma, through meditation practice. That's the hope. Does that make sense?
I think it does. And yeah. I will confirm that by trying to say some words back to you. And then you'll tell me where I've gone astray. But in meditation, one way you might experience emptiness is you start to see, and I'm basing this just on my own experiences, you pull yourself out of the world, you're on a retreat. That's the only time this has ever, quote unquote, worked for me. And many of the distractions of the world are gone. You're left in the first couple of days with your howling neuroses. And then over time, maybe those quiet down just a little bit. And so by day five or six in the silence with no schedule, or you don't have much of a traditional schedule, you're sitting and walking all day long, a few meals, the level of inner chatter might go down a little bit. And you start to see the raw data of your senses, seeing, hearing, smelling, feeling, thinking. And then you start to see, oh, this is all happening really fast. It's pain in my knee, random thought of something I'm going to say to my boss when I get home, making a plan, hearing a bird, and boom, 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 these so-called objects of meditation, the things one is aware of, start to speed up as your concentration ramps up. And after a while in this mode, you might see that things are moving too fast for there to be anything solid, including you. Where is the observer of all of this? You can't find it. And that can compute as terrifying. But the analogy that's often used is jumping out of an airplane. And at some point, it's thrilling. And then at some point, it's terrifying if you realize you didn't pack your parachute. And then the ultimate liberation is when you realize there's no ground to hit anyway. And so you might realize, oh yeah, there's nobody solid home here on some deep level, on some microscopic level, but that doesn't need to be terrifying. It's actually a sign of some deep and inextricable interweaving into the universe. The apex predator of all spiritual cliches, oneness with the universe, interconnection, et cetera, et cetera. So, okay, I've said a lot of words there. Does any of that make sense as one logical progression?
Yeah, I mean, All of that makes sense. In a way, it makes too much sense. It's sort of a traditional description of the progress of insight as handed down to us through the past couple of hundred years of the rediscovery of mindfulness and the charting of what might happen in meditation. And I think it's valid in a kind of removed way from what the actual emotional experience of the thing might be. You and I have a friend who just went on his first silent meditation retreat and came back and reported how impossibly difficult it was and what a struggle it was, and how after 4 or 5 days hearing an evening Dharma talk about shame and blame and so on, he came back to his room and suddenly and inexplicably started weeping and realizing that he thought he was coming to the meditation retreat to watch his mind and watch his thoughts the way you're describing. But really, the retreat, he realized, was about listening to his heart, and that what he felt was all the anger and blame and so on that he had been generating in his attempt to maintain control in the world, how that had been hurting his own heart. And that's where the tears were coming from. And that was such a profound realization, much more than even seeing the insubstantiality and so on of the momentary thought, the way you're describing, that was such an opening, like listening to his own heart and feeling the pain that he had been causing himself through his own mind. I think that is actually much closer to a true progress of insight than the way we're kind of traditionally taught it's supposed to look. But I think it's like completely idiosyncratic. And that's part of the beauty and the mystery of it, that each one of us, when we let ourselves go into these environments and just do the practice the way we're taught, it unfolds in a unique and personal way, even though you could chart it as a universal kind of progression.
Amen to all of that. Just a question. Our mutual friend's recent meditative insight about listening to his heart.
Yeah.
What does that have to do with emptiness?
Well, emptiness as the mother's love, it has a lot to do with it. I think the way it has something to do with emptiness is that in his, in his previous incarnation, which is overdoing it, but in his pre-retreat mind, part of what must have been motivating his inner critic, which you've called it, in your own book, part of what was motivating that was the need to be right, the need to control, the need for certainty, the need to blame. So that's all anti-emptiness. That's all, what's the real opposite of emptiness?
Taking it personally.
Yeah, and being separate and trying to control and all of that. So when he feels the pain of that, the self-inflicted pain of that, what opens up is his heart. So what's opening up is the mother's love or the father's love or the husband's love or whoever he may be. What's opening up is love, which is relationality, which actually is emptiness because it's interconnection and the lack of separateness. It has to be. If any of this is real, it's not like there are alternate realities that you can stumble into through, it's the love or emptiness. It has to be intertwined, I would think.
That to me seems like it's worth unpacking, not because I'm skeptical, but just because I don't yet fully understand it. But I think what you're saying there is one can open one's heart, in other words, experience love and a sense of connection with other people. And that is, I think you're saying that is emptiness. That is seeing.
Yeah, that is what I'm saying.
You might not get the classical Buddhist insight into the self being an illusion or the insubstantiality of everything in the universe, but simply seeing that you are connected to others, that you have this capacity to love, that is emptiness.
Well, the big critique, of mindfulness as you and I have practiced it, the big critique from people who like sort of try it, but fine, I don't know if it's for me or not, or coming from other spiritual traditions, the big critique is that it's too dry and that it's so mental and that, like, where's the love? But I think it's there, and it's there in this way that we're trying to unpack. But it's not always presented that way. It's often taught in the way that you were first formulating it, that you're sitting from this observing place and you're seeing things on a finer and finer level, you know, that your notes per moment, your ability to know, you could define it mathematically. And as it increases, your understanding, your insight also dawns, et cetera. And there's a way that is, I think, keeping the emotional experience, the actual emotional experience of sitting with yourself mindfully over time, and what are the actual realizations, the personal realizations, you know, how are you really, what are you reflecting on in your mind? What motivation is changing as a result? And that's just not always talked about so easily. But the personal experience, you know, when someone comes and reports, when you're there as a teacher and you're really listening to people's emotional experience, it's much richer than just the generic progress of insight thing.
Coming up, Dr. Mark Epstein talks about critiques of mindfulness, the paradox of the self, and spiritual bypassing. The weather is getting warmer. Time to ditch my jackets and sweaters for shorts and tees. I used to waste my money on clothing that would only last one season. That was until I found Quince. Now I've got high-quality pieces that never go out of style that I will be wearing year after year. Quince has all the seasonal must-haves like 100% European linen shirts from $30, performance polos, and versatile flow-knit activewear. The best part, all Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes the savings on to us. And Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices, along with premium fabrics and finishes. I just made a big order at Quince.com. I got two pairs of sweatpants that I've just had for like a week, and I already love them. I'm wearing them all the time. Sweatpants are a huge deal to me because I work from home and I want to look reasonably good, you know, in front of my wife and stuff, but I want to be comfortable. And the Quince sweatpants do the trick. For me, the bottom line is they've got good looking stuff at low prices. Not a bad recipe. You should go ahead and upgrade your wardrobe. Go to quince.com/happier for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/happier to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/happier.
When it comes to hiring, don't go searching for the one. Just meet your match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/happier. Just go to Indeed.com/happier right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/happier. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Looking to deepen your meditation practice with a dash of both wisdom and humor? Dive into the 10% Happier Meditation app. Download it for free wherever you get your apps and get started today. I love the fact that as soon as you start talking about enlightenment, you're in an argument. And so one view of how enlightenment happens is in the old school Buddhism is called the progress of insight. And you, Mark, are saying that there's a way in which that can be a little bloodless. And I'm wondering, when you talk about the important realizations that are there to be had about your emotions and your relationships, from a Dharma standpoint, couldn't those be kind of dismissed as content or stories, the type of thing we're trying to transcend through seeing the reality of momentary existence?
I think all too often it gets dismissed a little too easily. Like even in your book, you know, like what's the subtitle of 10% Happiness?
I can't fucking remember. It's too
long. You can't. Come on. Well, it's like
how I reduced stress, tamed the voice in my head without losing my edge. A true story. I found self-help that actually works. A true story.
Yeah. You had so many. But anyway, it's like for me, what I remember from it, from that beginning story of yours, it's like the inner critic thing. And then you play with that as, well, you know, I'm 10%, you know, maybe it improved me by 10%. Like you discovering the sort of nastiness of your mind that had affected your personal interactions, you know, that was huge. And people relate to that. That's not just like an incidental mind moment to be treated like any other. That was a real life-changing insight in your own way, that's similar to our friend that I was talking about, where you were feeling the pain that you were causing yourself. And instinctively, once confronted with that, instinctively you wanted to change. Like that kindled something in your heart. You know what I'm saying?
You're 1,000,000% correct. I could imagine from the standpoint of some schools of Buddhism, the argument might be, and it's hard for me to play devil's advocate with much authority because I'm not a Buddhist scholar, but I could imagine the argument would be, well, what's truly liberating isn't just seeing how nasty the inner dialogue is, but seeing that the inner dialogue itself is insubstantial, is empty. You don't need to take it personally. It's all just spinning subatomic particles of the mind.
Yeah, I think that's really important and necessary, because just seeing, oh my God, look what my mind is really like, doesn't automatically free you from it. When you come home from the retreat and your family is irritating you like they always have, and when I come home from a retreat, my family is like, "Oh no," because he's like worse than ever, you know, because I'm like sensitized to myself, you know, everything is like too much. It's not like it's a miracle transformation. You see how painful it can be, and then you have to work with it. And in working with it, that's when, oh, those critical thoughts that seemed so valid, like I know I'm right about this and I have to make my point and extract the apology and so on, those are just thoughts. When you really look at them, they're completely insubstantial. And I don't have to be run by those kinds of thoughts, even though they keep coming. They're as relentless as ever in my mind. But as Joseph Goldstein always says, it's not what's happening in your mind, it's how you relate to it. Mm-hmm. And so what's changing from the meditation is that I don't have to relate to those thoughts as if they really matter. You know, I can start to see them just for what they are, as like a drag. But the last retreat that I was on with Joseph, he was like, I realized that a thought is just a little bit more than nothing, you know, and I thought that was such a good phrase.
I mean, working with thoughts is a great way to see the three characteristics right there. One is they're just changing all the time. Two, if you cling too much to them and take them personally or too seriously, you will suffer. And three, if you look for the thinker of the thoughts, you won't find him.
Yeah. But the motivation, see, I think the motivation for even doing all of that comes from those kinds of emotional experiences that we were talking about before. And then when you start looking at the Eightfold Path in that regard, right intention or right motivation, even right speech, right livelihood, whatever they all are, that starts to come alive for me, you know, as, oh, you've had a little bit of a realization. Now, how are you going to work with all of this in real life?
So just a reflection and then a question for people who are new to Buddhism. The Eightfold Path is one of the first pronouncements of the newly enlightened Buddha 2,600 years ago, if you believe the scriptures. And he laid out the path to enlightenment, and there were 8 steps. And then, and it's not quite a cookbook in that you do the 8 steps and you're done. There are 8, maybe a better way to say it would be 8 components or ingredients. And they include things like right mindfulness, right livelihood, right speech, et cetera, et cetera. So there's an ethical component, a meditative component, a viewpoint component or philosophical component. You, Mark, I believe were saying that, yes, you can get pretty technical about emptiness, not self, et cetera, et cetera. And those realizations are powerful, but let's not forget the quality of the heart that drives you to meditation in the first place, and that can change after you've done the practice.
Yes.
And so what does that quality of the heart, in other words, my suffering might lead me to the meditation cushion,
yeah,
and my insights on the practice might lead me to being less of a jerk to myself and others.
Yeah, that's the phrase you use, less of a jerk. Yeah.
Yes. Well, I use asshole, but what does that have to do with emptiness?
Well, again, I think it comes back to, like, when you're observing your own mind, you're not just like seeing random thoughts. It's not just the incidental randomness of your mind that makes such an impression. What you're seeing that's bracing and potentially motivational and transformative is you're seeing what a jerk you are, or what an asshole you can be, what an addict you are, how much pain you're causing yourself, how angry you are. That's what the real emotionally laden experience is. And that's where what are we longing for? We're longing to be free of a lot the self-inflicted pain. Certainly, there's enough other inflicted pain that we are also longing to be rid of. But so much of it is self-perpetuated, even when there's been terrible experiences that have happened earlier. So much of the residual feeling is self-perpetuated. And that's what one sees when one sits down to meditate. So what does that have to do with emptiness? We naturally take all of that very seriously. One of the writers and psychoanalysts who I look up to the most is this guy, Adam Phillips, who's a British child analyst who wrote the first biography of Winnicott, who's another important figure in my mind. But Adam Phillips, in one of his many books, talks about how the nostalgia for how we were mistreated in our childhood, the need to go back and extract an apology or an acknowledgement or make things better. That's our most violent nostalgias, is the phrase that he uses. Like we really want that. We really feel aggrieved, or at least I do. And that desire for, it's almost a kind of vengeance, is deeply embedded. And I think that's one of the most profound meditative experiences. So to begin to unpack that is to experience emptiness. You know, if that desire for vengeance is empty of self, then imagine how liberating that could be. So that's where me being a psychiatrist and a therapist and so on, is the Buddhist view has been helpful for me.
The Buddhist view is helpful, but you've spent many years and many, many books wrestling with some of the tensions between the psychological view and the Buddhist view. And I think a lot of it goes back to the question I asked earlier, that this temptation from a Buddhist standpoint to dismiss, might be too harsh of a word, or maybe it's the exact right word, the stories of our lives.
Yeah. I don't think there's any need to dismiss the stories, because the stories themselves contain the emptiness that is real.
So you can look at the desire for revenge or any other story that's been swirling since childhood or since through your ancestors or through your past lives, if you believe in that kind of thing. You can look at any of those stories and see the insubstantiality, and there's emptiness right there.
You can look at any of those stories and see the clinging. And you can see the way that those stories are being turned into self. And you can see the selfing, we might say, or the clinging. And it's in seeing the clinging that it liberates itself. When you release the clinging, what's left? And that's the insubstantiality that you're talking about. But I don't think you can leap over the clinging just to see the insubstantiality. Tibetans say, in order to find the self that doesn't exist, you first have to identify the way you experience the self. You can't just say, oh, it's, you know, not real. You have to really feel it deeply, how you experience your separate self. Where's the Dan Harris in you? You know, where's the Mark in me?
And to not do that might be a kind of what's referred to as spiritual bypass.
Yeah. Spiritual bypass usually means, oh, that something's bothering you, but you're not going to look at the thing that's bothering you. You're just going to watch your breath. And so you're never going to deal with, you know, what's wrong in your relationship to your kids or your spouse or your work or whatever. You're just going to be like, I'm cool. But this is like a bypass on another level. Like if you really want to understand selflessness, you first have to find the self that doesn't exist. And where is it? Where is it in you? And only you can find it.
And to make this even trickier, there's a paradox at work here. On a deep, deep level, on the subatomic level, the self doesn't exist. But on the conventional level, the chair I'm sitting in is a chair, and the guy I'm talking to is Mark. And so you kind of have to hold these two things in your mind simultaneously.
Yeah, the guy you're talking to is Mark, but who is Mark talking back? You know, from inside of Mark, it's much murkier. Inside of me, like, where is the Mark? Like, I remember myself from nursery school when my mother would come to pick me up and I didn't want to go. But she would say, the Mickey Mouse Club is on, you know, and I wanted to see Annette Funicello, you know. So, I remember that. Like, that's an early bit of Mark. But when I dig down looking for Mark, like, what do I find? But it's not like there's nothing. There's like stuff like that. So what do you do with that? You know, and there's a grievance that I've been nursing since before I can remember about maybe something should have happened, something more should have happened than did happen that got preserved in me as a different kind of emptiness. You know, like, what's wrong with me? Something's wrong with me. I don't really know what it is, but that you seem to have more of whatever it is, you know, than I do. And I'm a little insecure as a result. And is that, that's, like, I really could identify with that as that sort of essence of Mark, but that's ridiculous, you know.
So I think what you're saying is that you can look inside yourself, and when you look inside yourself, you see, as you said, a different kind of emptiness. Like, part of the story of Mark is that there's some dysfunction, there's something missing or wrong that other people seem to have. And we all, I think, have stories like that, whether they're examined or not.
Not everybody does, but there are some people who don't, but a lot of people do.
But everybody's got some story internally. It might not have to do with unique.
Most people seem to, yeah.
And there's a way, and from a Buddhist standpoint, that, and this may be a misinterpretation of what's being said from the front of the meditation hall, but often at least is an intimation that, hey, let's not get too hung up on these stories, because the point here is to see not the content of the mind, but the process of the mind, the way the mind works. And I think much of your work has been about, whoa, 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 actually, there's data in these stories that can bring us to deep dharmic understandings of things like emptiness.
Yeah, I think that's accurate. I think that a lot of my work has been trying to make room for that and to see the validity of that approach. You know, that there is material there that's worth paying attention to from a dharmic perspective. That the seed of the self that doesn't exist, it lies in that content, or at least in the clinging to the content. And you can't get to the, you know, you have to get to the clinging in order to not cling. And the way to get to the clinging might be through the content, not just dismissing the content.
Yeah, just to see how am I relating to this old story I've got. Once you can, this is a tricky word, but like detach or be non-attached vis-a-vis these ancient storylines, as you said earlier, okay, well, what's left then? What's left then is you can see, well, this is a passing, a repeated pattern in the mind, but I can't put my thumb on it. Like I can't find these thoughts. It's like grasping at a cloud. And that is where a key learning can take place.
The other day I was listening to your one of your podcasts and you were quoting Ram Dass as being a connoisseur of his neurosis. Like that's where the meditative path had led him. And I remember him talking, instead of seeing them as big monsters, they start to appear as little schmooze, he would say. And so I really like that. Like that's more along the lines of what I think you and I are talking about here, that by not just dismissing, but by finding the way we inflate the content or cling to the content, and then seeing the humor in that, the sort of tragic humor in that, that we can lessen either the hold that it has over us, or the, that's one way of saying it, or the way we cling to, you know, that violent nostalgia. You could talk about the progress of insight in those terms also. Mm-hmm. You know, that in becoming a connoisseur of your neurosis, you're also becoming a connoisseur of the insubstantiality of your neurosis.
Coming up, Mark talks about turning down the volume on your ego and focusing on other people and self-acceptance and compassion. I want to tell you about a podcast you should check out. It's called ADHD Aha, and it's hosted by Laura Key. It's candid stories from people who share the moment it clicked that they or someone they know has ADHD. It can be hard to understand what ADHD is by looking at a list of symptoms. In every episode, you'll hear heartfelt interviews about the unexpected, emotional, and even funny ways ADHD symptoms surface for adults. I checked out an episode of ADHD Aha, and I thought it was quite moving to hear from a guy who talked about learning when he was in the fifth grade that he actually had a diagnosis and that he wasn't, as everybody else had told him, including his teachers, dumb. This is actually not dissimilar to something I've seen with my wife, who lived with ADHD undiagnosed until her 30s and harbored real suspicions that she was unworthy. And then getting that diagnosis was massively clarifying for her. To listen to ADHD Aha, search for ADHD Aha in your podcast app. That's ADHD Aha with Aha spelled A-H-A. Check it out. The good folks from Tidy Care Alert sent us some kitty litter in the mail. That's not normally the kind of thing you want to get in the mail, but when you have four cats, it's actually a very exciting development. So we've been using Tidy Care Alert, and our cats seem to be very happy. They're pooping away very happily. Tidy Care Alert has long-lasting ammonia control, so your house won't smell like you have cats. It's low dust and lightweight, and it's from the brand most often recommended and personally used by veterinarians. Tidy Care Alert uses color-changing crystals to detect potential concerns and help you put your mind at ease. Let Tidy Care Alert help keep an eye on your cat's health. Whether you have one cat or you're a crazy person like me and my wife and our son, and you have four cats, they make it easy to track. Tidy Care Alert. Let's get back to mother's love. The way I hear it is, and it kind of goes back to what we were saying before about jumping out of an airplane, seeing the insubstantiality of like everything can be deeply destabilizing, right? Because it's like, I have nothing to stand on here. There's no ground. They often refer to this as the rolling up the mats stage of meditation. I think what you're saying is, yeah, it might compute initially as scary, but it's pointing to something deeply reassuring, which is this embeddedness in everything that exists there is no essence of Mark. Mark is made up of all sorts of non-Mark elements, atoms from the first exploding stars, et cetera, et cetera. And that actually should be really comforting. And that's tied to the mother's love because it has to do with relationality.
Let me say it a different way. There is an essence of Mark, and the essence of Mark would be love. What is a mother's love? A mother's love is such that in the face of the child or the infant's ruthless attack or aggression, a mother neither abandons or retaliates, right? A mother stays present through anything that the infant throws at her because she loves the child, because the child came from her. That ability to stay present, to not retaliate and not abandon, that's what we're doing in meditation with ourselves. We're staying present with everything. We're not clinging, we're not condemning, we're not holding on, we're not pushing away. I mean, at our best. Not that anyone really can do this, but we're trying. But a mother really does this. There's no choice. You know, a good enough mother doesn't retaliate, doesn't abandon. And that capacity to be neither one nor the other is what helps a child, what helps an infant relativize their anger, their aggression. That's what helps a child not think that their anger is totally destructive, because no matter how angry they get, no matter what they throw at the mother survives. So therefore, their anger is not murderous. Because the mother survives, that then the child gradually grows into an ability to empathize with her as a separate person who they don't have total control over. You follow all this?
Yes, I'm in the back of my mind, I'm trying to connect it to emptiness, but I'm with you thus far.
The mother's love, her ability to stay present no matter what, makes the child's anger not be total. That thing about the entitativeness of the anger, it makes the anger be relative because it can't totally destroy. So that right away is the experience of the emptiness of the anger. It's like, okay, it flares up. It doesn't destroy. The mother's still there. The child thinks, you know, I'm going to pound you to bits because you didn't give me what I wanted immediately. But there she still is. And what a relief. You're still here. And that, in a reduced primal form, that's what we're doing in meditation also. We're both mother and child in the meditation.
Right. And this is what is sometimes referred to as reparenting.
Yes.
A term you don't love.
I don't mind. We're replaying something where there's a second chance at all of that. It doesn't always go perfectly when we're young, which is why we're left with these feelings of grievance that we hold tightly to. But then when we're on the meditation retreat and we're just with ourselves and we're seeing how all that patterning, all that conditioning has affected our minds, we have a chance to do it over again in a different way. Because we're not just the child anymore.
And I apologize for if any of this is obtuse. I'm struggling in my mind to connect it to insubstantiality, emptiness, this kind of absolute interconnection. And I think what you're saying is reality is doing for us what our moms, if we had one, did ideally, which is, yeah, that's as far as I can take it.
The word absoluteness that you just used, I think that's the, when we're angry, we're really angry. We think we're absolutely right. A baby, an infant angry is absolutely angry, right? There's like nothing but the anger. The mother's ability to temper that, to ultimately to joke about it, to lighten it for the child. You have a kid. You remember when he was little, you know, when the child's hungry or tired or can't get what they want and having a fit inside you, you might feel like you just want to slap them down and shut them up. or leave the room, but you're not going to do either. You're going to stay with it. And if you're lucky, you're going to gradually like distract them or give them something to play with or joke a little bit about, I know, it's all right. You're pissed. Come on. So that the gradual lightening that you're doing instinctively, that's what we're doing in meditation. The thoughts come, the memories come, the angers come, the emotions come, the difficulties come, and we're just there. Okay, another thought, not clinging, not condemning, not holding on, not pushing away, just allow, be open, see the humor in it. We're just doing that. We're just doing that to ourselves because our minds are like that angry infant that we haven't really come that far, except we have that maternal capacity. It's not just maternal, you know, it's paternal also. We have that parental capacity. That's what mindfulness is. A mother does it instinctively. She doesn't have to go to a meditation retreat to learn how to be a mother. It's there in us already. We're on the meditation retreat, we're laboriously bringing it out, you know, listening to Joseph Goldstein tell us how to do it. But it's in us already. When you find the balance in mindfulness, you know that you have it. It rings true and you can kind of settle into it. And that has a calming effect on the emotional body, not just on the thinking mind.
All of that makes complete sense. Where I fear some level of thickness on my end is connecting it to insubstantiality.
Well, that relationship between absoluteness and insubstantiality, I think that's the important link. Like we take ourselves so seriously, but when you start to lighten up about it, that's where the insubstantiality starts to creep in.
And I think maybe where I'm going in my head with this that's causing the confusion that I fear is almost entirely on me is I keep waiting for you to make an argument that you may have already made, but I missed, which is something about that. Like once you see through this illusion of entitativeness, some sort of stop imbuing some sort of permanence and essence, core-ness to yourself and other people and other things in the universe, what's left is a mother's love. What's left is relationality.
Well, what's left is everything. What I'm imagining, listening to you, rephrasing what I'm trying to say, like when I go on a meditation retreat, I'll just do it from a personal point of view. When I come into the retreat, I'm basically obsessed with my own reality. When I sit and close my eyes, I'm thinking about my life, my family, my patients, what I'm upset about, what I'm not upset about. In the deep recesses of my own mind, I'm very self-centered because what else would I be? I'm just carrying my own experience, you know, whatever it is, I'm carrying my whole history. And then gradually, a lot of those thoughts will repeat them, those memories, all that will repeat themselves and I'll get like sort of bored with them. But some of them will be very sticky and I can feel how identified I am with being, you know, this person or that person and the whole trajectory of my life. And I might spend more time on the stickiness of those particular things. But as all that loosens and fades out, as I'm less self-centered as a result of just being exhausted by it or seeing through it, you know, as one tends to do if you're there long enough on the retreat, what's left? Joseph would say open space. There's that famous Zen haiku, barn burns down, now I can see the moon. So the barn burning down is like the self-centeredness burning down, disappearing. You know, what's left? Now I can see the moon. What's the moon? And Zen, you know, it's your awareness or it's, you know, the night sky illuminated by the moon. What are you know, what is the experience on the retreat becomes? It's like the outside. The walks and the wind and the trees and the birds, the outside landscape or the inner landscape. And what's the inner landscape when you're not so self-centered? That I think that's where the mother's love comes in. You know, what's left when you take everything out? It's not just empty. There's a lot of love there in all of us. And that tends to fill the space.
The way this has worked for me, I think, is when I can get to the point of not taking myself so seriously and not being so self-centered, which is rare, but when it does happen, yeah, I do see that what is left is everything, is the world. There's another Zen haiku. I think it goes something like this. We sit together, the mountain and me. The mountain is all that remains.
Something like that.
Yeah. So it's like the me is out of the picture. It's just the world. And love is a bit of a loaded term because we think about it as usually we bucket
romantic
it.
Love. Yeah.
Yeah. Romantic love or even parental love. But I think of love roughly as anything north of neutral, like the innate capacity we all have to, and this is a little glib, but to give a shit, to care on some level. And that just, I think if knocking it off its plinth in that way, knocking it off its pedestal just a little bit, makes it more achievable and understandable. And when you get a sense of how interconnected you are, you start realizing that, of course, it's natural to care about everyone and everything else, because that's you.
Yeah, it's natural to care. I think it's a real visceral experience. I think it actually comes and fills you. And that's incredibly enlightening, like clarifying that we really are relational creatures and we really are all here part of this bigger thing. And we really do care. And that just becomes true.
Do we need to go on a meditation retreat to have this dawning realization? Can we have it in regular life?
Yeah, I think one can get it in all different kinds of ways. It's mostly that it doesn't stick around. Like you can take a psychedelic drug and have a big experience of it. But, you know, I know a lot of people who've taken a lot of psychedelic drugs and not really been transformed by it. And I think you can have that experience in a good therapy. You can have it in just taking a walk. You can certainly have it on a meditation retreat. It's more the persistence of it is, I think, where the real challenge is. To know it in an ongoing way so that it actually changes the way you behave. That's a hard one, I think.
Well, you called it a challenge. How do you personally meet that challenge?
Personally, in doing the work that I do, in terms of being a therapist with people, when I'm just doing that, it's sort of like being focused in a meditation. It's much easier to keep myself out of it, or to hone whatever it is that is that I am for a distinct purpose, being, you know, trying to make a difference for the other. I think I'm much more dangerous in my regular life.
Because the I reasserts itself.
Yeah.
Our mutual friend, Michael Vincent Miller, who used to be your therapist when you were younger and is a couples therapist for me and my wife. You introduced me to him. Thank you.
Wow.
He's amazing. And Michael, if you're listening, I know you're working on a new book. When that comes out, I want you on the show, please. We had a conversation that I found to be devastating. He didn't mean it to be devastating, but he said that you, Dan, this is him talking, are kind of like the apex of the Western man, Western human, in that you've worked a lot on I skills, the letter I skills, you know, achievement oriented skills, but you need to get better at you skills, other people stuff. And I heard that as well. This kindly elderly therapist is telling me I'm a monster, but he didn't mean it that way. And this was 5 years ago. And I have spent a lot of time thinking about that. And I'm saying this because I think it rhymes with what you're saying about the challenge of remembering our relationality is you need to develop these skills that help you turn down the eye, that's Miller's term, and be more focused on other people. So for you, it happens naturally through 8 to 10 hours a day of therapy. For the rest of us, we need to find the skills, meditation, being a patient in therapy, taking walks in nature, whatever. We need to find the skills to turn down the I and turn up the you. Does that go down easy for you?
Yeah, I think that all sounds right to me. I would just add what I was trying to say before, which is that I think the way of turning down the I is to truly experience the I.
Yes.
So in taking that walk, it's not just getting away from the I, which is a little bit, you know, when I was saying that in my work, there's a little bit of that in what I'm saying, that I'm just turning myself off. And so then, you know, when I come back into my life, there I am again, you know, optimally, that wouldn't be the ultimate best thing to be doing. In taking the walk to pay attention to the eye, thereby to release some of the clinging to the I-ness of it, to the grievance of it. Our friend who I talked about at the retreat, that like listening to his heart, feeling the self-inflicted pain that's been going on unconsciously. I think that's where the hope is, that we actually can do that for ourselves. Mm-hmm. And there's some of the reparenting that's going on in that, the way the mother helps the child not take itself so seriously because his or her diaper is wet, that we can help ourselves in an analogous way.
Another little anecdote here, personal anecdote. I always hesitate to do this a little bit because I'm interviewing you and I don't want to turn up the eye on myself, but I'm saying this because I think it might be illuminating or helpful, or yeah, at least I hope it will be. For me, in my own practice, the introduction of what is often referred to as loving kindness or metta, M-E-T-T-A practice, has been very helpful in doing what I believe you just described. So many people listening know what metta practice is, but it basically is, you know, where you envision a series of beings and then send them phrases like, may you be happy, may you be safe, et cetera, et cetera. And many people don't like this practice because it feels forced and treacly and all of that stuff. And I was definitely in that category. What it helped me do, I believe, is to be okay with the horrors of my own personality, to see my greed, my selfishness, my anger, my hatred, and not take it as personally. It kind of just turned up the warmth in my own mind so that I could do what I believe you're describing, which is turn down the eye by getting comfortable with the eye.
How did it do that, do you think? I find that interesting, what you're saying.
It made me view the contents of my own consciousness with more warmth, just the way I was developing this capacity through this very forced exercise of envisioning people and saying, may you be happy, safe, healthy, live with ease. And then in the progression of metta or loving kindness meditation, and for you skeptics out there, there's been a lot of science around this practice, and science seems to indicate that it has all sorts of physiological and psychological benefits. And the progression of these beings, you insert at some point yourself.
Yeah.
And so what I found was that as a frosty New Englander, forcing myself to bring out something that was always within me, which is this warmth, you might call it love, but again, in the broadest understanding.
Yeah, compassion,
of term,
you could
love.
Just call it. Yeah,
yeah, compassion, absolutely. Yeah. I like friendliness.
Yeah, I like that too.
When inevitably in my practice, the parts of my personality that I don't like would trot onto the scene. You know, I think my practice hitherto was to note it with some sort of clinical clarity to see, oh yeah, that's anger, that's anger. But I think there was a subtle aversive flick within the mindfulness that was preventing me from really being cool with it. And once I was able to bring the metta on board, the whole machinery became more tractable.
Yeah, I really like what you're saying. I wrote this little piece for Tricycle a couple of years ago about an experience I had when I was doing the audiobook of Going to Pieces Without Falling Apart. So it was a long time. It's like 25 years ago now, 20 years ago, something like that. But you've probably, well, you know, as a podcast, TV person, all that. But for me, doing the audiobook, I had never done anything like that before. And so I was in a recording studio and like in a little a telephone booth sort of thing with headphones on and the engineer outside of the booth. And I had to read the book perfectly. You know, I couldn't change any of the words or cough or make a movement or anything because it had to be a pure recording. And when I was little, I used to stutter and I would have a really hard time when we went around the room in school and had to say our names. I could never get the M sound of Mark out. And so I would get all hot inside myself and twisted up and very embarrassed and so on. And my parents sent me to a speech therapist who really helped me. I think it was like an early kind of teaching about meditation, like just how to relax myself instead of being so down on myself. But anyway, when I was in the recording booth, the beginning words in Going to Pieces, I couldn't get the first sound out. It was like a regression to when I was little. And one of the tricks that that speech therapist had showed me was, oh, if you can't say the word, if you can't say Mark, you know, if you just started a different way. So I would often say, my name is Mark. And somehow by inserting the phrase, my name, I could trick myself into like, but so always, like, I haven't stuttered in a long time overtly, but inside I could sometimes feel the tendency and I would just change the phrase a little bit and be fine. But because it was my own book and I had to read it perfectly just as it was, I couldn't change the phrase of the beginning of the book. So I was stuck inside this booth and it was like probably a couple of minutes, but it seemed like forever. And finally I heard the engineer in my ears saying, Dr. Epstein, is everything okay in there? And I was like, oh no, here I'm like the Buddhist psychiatrist, you know, writing about meditation and I can't even like read my own words. So I've tried many years later, I tried to write about that experience in some kind of Buddhist Dharmic way for Tricycle, the Buddhist Review. And I labored over it, but finally got to the end. And I realized through writing about it and reflecting on it that much, I could feel a kind of compassion in myself for my younger self. My younger self, who I both was and wasn't still that person. I'm mangling the grammar of it, but I did it better in the piece. The younger me that in some sense was still in me and yet wasn't. And that was such a essence of, even though we're not supposed to have an essence, that was such an essence of metta directed towards a place in myself that's very sticky, you know, I'm still very embarrassed about, identified with, ashamed of, you know. It was actually in the writing led me to that feeling of kindness, as you would say, friendliness. Something nice about writing sometimes.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And there are a lot of things that are not so nice as well. But yeah. I really like that story because it is absolutely what I was trying to say, that if you can develop some warmth, compassion, kindness, friendliness vis-a-vis the most difficult and sticky aspects of your personality, then you can relax. You're not taking it seriously. And then you're more available for other people because you're less stuck with your head up your own ass. And
you're more available for yourself too.
Yes, of course. It's all, in the end, it's all the same thing in some ways.
Yeah.
Anything I should have asked but failed to ask here, Mark? This has been a lot of fun.
God knows what you should have asked. I think you did fine. Okay. Anything I should have said that I didn't say?
No. I wasn't looking for reassurance. I just wanted to make sure I didn't. If there was something you wanted to say that I didn't give you a chance to say.
No. I always like talking to you.
Likewise. Actually, along those lines, I do want to say thank you because you are in many ways a sine qua non of this whole crazy adventure that I've been on for the last 15 years, for sure the last 10 years since the book came out. Meeting Mark was a key juncture for me in terms of getting interested in Buddhism and meditation. And I have clear memories of, you know, having labored over this book for 5 years and it came out and I really was worried that it was going to ruin my career or just whatever. And then ended up doing really well. And nobody was happier for me than you. And I remember being at an event with you to help launch the book. And it was a week or so after the book came out. And you asked me how it was doing. And I told you what where it was on the chart or something like that. And it was uncontrived, what the Buddhists call mudita, this very hard skill of being happy for somebody else's happiness. So anyway, long way of saying thank you for everything.
Well, total pleasure. Thank you.
Anything else we should discuss before I let you go? Anything else you want to let people know about that you've made and put out into the world? I'm going to plug all of your books, but do you have a website where people can go or anything like
There's a website. There's a website that just has my books on it. So great. It's Mark Epstein, MD, but it just has the books.
Although you and I have been plotting, we haven't figured out the details yet, have been plotting doing a meditation retreat that people can sign up for. We haven't figured out
where
or when.
I know, I'm excited. I'm interested in how that might be.
Yeah, well, I owe you an email with some more details. But yes, just everybody know that Mark and I have been plotting something special, a small little meditation retreat that people can sign up for if they're interested. And so details to come. Mark, thank you again. This was a huge pleasure. Really appreciate you.
Totally welcome, Dan. Nice for me too.
Thanks again to Mark. Always great to talk to him at any time. And I'm so glad I sent him that email as promised, because we do now have a retreat on the books, as I mentioned at the top of the show. It's coming up January 17th, 2025, so plenty of lead time here. It's going to be at Miraval, which is a beautiful facility, a beautiful spa in Arizona. Details in the show notes. Thank you as well to everybody who works so hard on this show. 10% Happier is produced by Gabrielle Zuckerman, Justine Davey, Lauren Smith, and Tara Anderson. DJ Kashmir is our senior producer. Marissa Schneiderman is our senior editor. Kevin O'Connell is our director of audio and post-production. And Kimmy Regler is our executive producer. Alicia Mackey leads our marketing. And Tony Magyar is our director of podcasts. And finally, Nick Thorburn of the great band Islands wrote our theme. We'll see you right back here very soon for a brand new episode as we continue our 10th anniversary series. If you like 10% Happier, and I hope you do, you can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music. Before you go, tell us about yourself by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman, from Wondery. Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in our newest season, we track the power struggles within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it all says about the future and safety of artificial intelligence. Make sure to follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dives and daily business content, listen to Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like The Best One Yet, Business Wars, and many more. Let me tell you, Wondery means business.
50 high school senior girls descend on Mobile, Alabama every summer to compete for a massive cash prize. It isn't Survivor. It's one of America's most lucrative scholarship competitions for teen girls. It's been around for 7 decades. Now you'll hear what took place behind the scenes. From Pineapple Street Studios and Wondery, this is The Competition. I'm your host, Shimo Liai, and I was Nevada's contestant 20 years ago. Now I'm returning as a judge to find out what 2 weeks with 50 of the country's most ambitious teens can tell us about girlhood in America. What happens when the competitors are thrown into the deep end with the best and brightest? And how does surviving the competition prepare them for everything that comes after? Follow The Competition on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can binge all episodes of The Competition early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.